You're listening to Megiddo Radio. Megiddo Radio is a radio ministry of Megiddo Media. For more, visit our website at MegiddoRadio.com. That's MegiddoRadio.com.
Welcome, everybody. This is Paul Flynn with Megiddo Radio. It is the 13th of April that this is being recorded on. Apologies, it's been a few weeks. Through a couple of things occurring, it's going to set back this program a few weeks. So apologies for that. We're going to be looking at a topic that I was teaching a class on a few weeks ago, and I thought it'd be a good topic to cover on the program, and that is the one we're going to be dealing with here this evening, which is God Without Passions, or it is also called Divine Impassibility. Divine Impassibility, or you could also think of it as this: does God suffer? Does God suffer? Now, this doctrine, God Without Passions, even from the very title, is very easy to misunderstand. And for years, whenever I'd hear this put forward in some books and in other places, whenever it's mentioned with nervousness, a kind of an unease, and people kind of knew what heresy was and how to stay away from it, but not quite how to express this doctrine in a positive way that people could not comprehend, because God is incomprehensible. He is immeasurable in His greatness. He is infinite. But to apprehend and to know and describe God as revealed in His holy word. And so for years, I remember, I have seen people deal with this topic before, and I wondered, is it that important, honestly? And in my sinful ignorance, I wondered if this was just kind of one of those highfalutin ideas that really doesn't matter. And over the years, I saw, whoa, this really does matter for a multitude of different reasons. Not least of which, when this doctrine, God Without Passions, is denied, you end up with a God who is changeable. You end up with a God who is a product of the minds of men. And you end up with a God who is really just a better version of ourselves, rather than a God who is holy, holy, holy. Now, as I said, this doctrine is easy to misunderstand. And it's easy to misunderstand it as if that God is without, that it means that God doesn't care. God doesn't love us. God doesn't, or anything like that. But rightly understood, God Without Passions is a God who is not suffered to change away from being Him who is most loving. We think of God when we hear this doctrine, and this is the straw man or the caricature that is put forward by opponents of divine impassibility, God Without Passions, is that it makes God a motionless block, an inert block, when nothing could be further from the truth. God is pure. He's far from being inert. He's pure act. He is without passive, what the older theologian called passive potential, as in, he is not in any way mixed up of act and passiveness or potential. What I mean by that is this. For example, you're sitting down right now. You have the potential to get up and run around, or the potential to be more active. God is infinite in that aspect. And when we see that God is not a mixture of active and passive, for example, as in our God is simple, he is without parts, the confession refers to that, we see we have a God who is most loving. So this doctrine really shows us that God is most loving, most pure, and will not be suffered to change from being that God. He doesn't become. He is pure in who he is. And again, I say, don't expect to completely comprehend this. We can apprehend this, but we cannot comprehend this. And as soon as you have a God who you can completely comprehend, you have an idol whom you formed out of your own mind. You have a creature. Our God is incomprehensible. We will never completely comprehend this. And that really shouldn't leave us worried. Friends, as we go forward in this study, do not let your heart be troubled by this, because the God we will worship for all eternity leaves us eternally in awe when we are with him in heaven. If you love Jesus Christ, if you've been saved by the blood of the Lamb, if you've turned away from your sin and put your trust in Jesus Christ alone, you will never reach a point of being bored or exhausted. You will be forever in awe of him and in enjoyment of him, because he is incomprehensible. He is holy. And I just want to think about this before we get into our study proper. These are still kind of introductory remarks. God is holy. What does that mean? And I think we often think of holy as pure, separate from sin. And you're getting closer to it. But holy, yes, is separate from sin, but also separate from creation. From any creature, God is different and cannot be compared to anything in this world or anything that has a beginning and an end and anything that is subject to change. God is separate, set apart, different. That's what holy means. He's different from us. So while we've been created in the image of God, and there are points of similarity, there are, well, you know, we have love, we have hatred, all these kind of things. God is infinite. We are finite. And infinite means without limit. We have limitations. So God is different from us. And we must approach God in that way. Especially as we think of God without passions. We have passions. But God does not have passions or affections. But we'll get into this definition later on. Just making a little comment about history now. The history of the doctrine, from my limited enough look throughout church history, any references that I can find or have come across have all been in favor of God without passions, as found in the Westminster Confession of Faith, paragraph, or chapter 2, paragraph 1. The church has held, basically the church has held to this for thousands of years. During the Reformation, both Rome and the Reformers both held to this truth. Now we've got to realize that during the Reformation, the Reformers didn't toss out everything. They didn't just say, well, Rome has gotten everything wrong. That is a view of history that's more in line with what we call Socinianism or Anabaptism, 16th century Anabaptists, where basically the idea is like you scrap it all, it doesn't matter what's gone before, we start from scratch. So the Reformers, especially the likes of Peter Martyr Vermilly, Calvin, and so on, were very much, when it came to theology proper, the church had not drifted in that. The church, whether it's the writings of Thomas Aquinas or Augustine, whoever else, when it came to this, sure, there was work to be done on the doctrine of the church and the sacraments and the grace and salvation, especially the gospel, absolutely. The Reformers spent much of their writing on that because that's where the corruptions had come into. But not everything that the Church of Rome taught was wrong. So you can find this doctrine of divine impassibility throughout church history, early church, medieval church. And whether you're talking about the Church of Rome, which apostatized from the true gospel, or the Protestant Reformation, and from what I can see as well, even the Arminians and other groups as well. And for anyone to depart from this, especially during the time of the Reformation, you would be seen as a heretic. I point this out because we're in quite we're in a bad way. Because there's many people today who are Calvinists or whatever else, and to varying degrees either have modified this doctrine or have rejected this doctrine out of hand. This doctrine has been challenged, changed, or redefined in recent years, even by people who would be fairly good on many areas. And I say that not to ambassador them or anything else like that, but to give us a sober assessment of the situation and why we need to, it's good to read modern authors, I'm not saying don't, but it's good to also realize there are deficiencies. And if you don't read the men of the past, you're going to be a product of the major deficiencies of theology for the last 100 to 200 years, especially the last 200 years. Don't just have this idea, well, you know, our theology is getting better and better. It's important, especially if you're a minister or an elder or whatever, try to read men from different periods of church history. By all means, read men of the modern day. But read the men of old. Read obviously the Calvins, Matthew Henry, Baptists like John Gill. Read widely. So, the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now, we, and I say we as the church, don't believe this just because it's confessional. It's taught in the Word of God, and we profess and we believe and we confess this truth as part of the Confession of Faith. Could have dug this out in a few places, and this has been held to, you can find that what I'm quoting here from chapter 2, paragraph 1 of the Westminster Confession of Faith. You can find this in the 39 Articles, from what I remember, 1689, on the Baptist Confession of Faith, and this was in a lot of ways on the Baptist Confession of Faith. It was really an edited version of the Westminster Confession of Faith in a lot of ways, and Savoy Declaration. So this is not unique just to the Westminster Confession of Faith. Any good, sound, reformed confessional creed will have this, or will have at least by implication a belief in this. It says in chapter 2, paragraph 1, but there is one living and true God. And a little bit later in that paragraph, paragraph 1 of chapter 2, it says, without body, parts, or passions. Without body, parts, or passions. Without body, we have anthropomorphisms in the scriptures. Anthropomorphisms is creaturely language, speaking of God as if he had arms and legs and all these kind of things. But we know that God doesn't have body. It says, with a body, parts, there's a comma in between there, parts, we're talking, he's not a mixture of, he is pure in act, he's not mixed up of active and passive potential. He is not, as they would say, substance and accidents. Accidents are modes of being that are not essential to the being itself. So God is pure. Divine simplicity would be that doctrine, and won't spend long on that, but James Dolezal will be a good reference for that, especially all that is in God is God. Might be a good place to start there. So that's that part. So there's a lot of things in these words, with a body, parts, or passions. And that's what we're going to spend our time on today. Passions. And of the three, it's probably one of the ones that I spend a lot of time trying to apprehend. Again, we're not going to be able to completely comprehend these things. In the Confession of Faith, it references Acts chapter 14, verse 15, and I'm going to read for context from verse 11 onwards. And when the people saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in the speech of Laodicea, the gods are come down to us in the likeness of men. And they called Barnabas Jupiter, and Paul Mercurius, because he was the chief speaker. Then the priest of Jupiter, which was before their city, brought oxen and garlands unto the gates, and would have done sacrifice with the people, which when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of, they rent their clothes and ran in among the people, crying out, and this is the important verse here, verse 15, and saying, sirs, why do you these things? We also are men of like passions with you, and preach unto you that ye should turn from these vanities unto the living God, which made heaven and earth and the sea and all things that are therein. So verse 15 is very, very important here for a proof text of divine impassibility or God without passions. If you would like something a little bit longer than what I'm going to explain here, I did preach a message recently on Acts chapter 14 and verse 15 called Whom Do You Worship? And I just preached in verse 15. That is, you can find that on Sermon Audio. It was preached at the Presbyterian Reformed Church in Stockton-on-Tees their last Sabbath morning. That's when it was. So if you would like to listen to that, but because this is only really going to be part of this presentation here. But what is Paul saying? What's Paul's argument? So you have those of Lystra, these idolaters. They see Paul and Barnabas, especially Paul, but you know, in the present, they wish to worship Paul and Barnabas. They see this miraculous feat, this thing that is referenced in verse 9, that man who was healed, a cripple from his mother's womb, never walked. And this is very impressive. And they're looking at these pagans, which would be in Lystra, I think, it's like the middle of modern-day Turkey. And they come, and they think the gods are come down to us in the likeness of men. So they have a wrong idea of who God is and who should be worshipped. What is Paul's argument to saying to the people, stop, why are you worshipping us? Now, at first glance, it may appear that Paul is saying, we're just like you. Why would you want to worship us? We are men, verse 15, of like passions with you. And there's a certain element of truth to that. I'm not saying that it's completely wrong. There is a sense of which, if you ever meet people who are fairly famous and maybe a lot of respect for them, and you meet them and they're not as impressive as you think, they're just men like you. No, you shouldn't idolize anybody. Things like that. But there's more to it than that. The modern translations actually mostly translate it same nature. We are men of same nature with you. We're just like you. And that's the sense that comes across from most modern translations, which is a pity because you're missing out on something far more profound than just, we're just like you, why are you worshipping us? While that is true, you miss the depth of Paul's argument, which is kind of brought out really well by what's called Young's Literal Translation. Now, Young's Literal Translation was never used in the pulpit or anything like that, but it's a very wooden literal translation. I think it was done about 200 years ago. And it renders this, we are men like affected with you. Like affected with you. If you look at the Greek language, it's like the word is like homoi and pathes, which is kind of like passions or affections. Or put it this way, we are men who are affected by things like you. What's Paul's argument in verse 15? Essentially this, we are of the same affections. We suffer to change just like you do. We are mutable, that's changeable creatures, caused to undergo change because we're creatures. We're not like God who is asse, which is aseity, which is he's completely self-dependent or reliant. He isn't caused to change by anything outside of himself. We are affected, Paul is telling Paul and Barnabas, by things just like you. We are suffered to undergo change. So why would you worship us? Mere creatures with passions. And that is Paul's argument. We are of passions. You need to turn to the one who is without passions. The one who is without passions, who is not suffered to change. The living God, which made heaven and earth and the sea and all things that are therein, it's to him you need to look. It's to him you need to worship. Who does not suffer to undergo change. The difference between the creator of heaven and earth, the sustainer of heaven and earth, the maintainer of heaven and earth, and you and I, is he is without passions and we have passions. John Trapp said this. Just dig it out here in his commentary on Acts chapter 14 and verse 15. And Trapp writes this, passions are here put for whatsoever differentieth man from the divine nature. So Trapp is saying, passions here is the difference between us and God. So as soon as you have a God with passions, you no longer have the divine nature. It's a creature, suffered to undergo change. John Trapp's commentary is excellent. If you ever get John Trapp's commentary is different, though, I'll also point this out, as I quote it. I think RHB have it in print, but the way I would use it is, and I've heard somebody else describe this this way, you've done all your work on your sermon and everything else, and you want just a little bit of spice, something a little bit interesting, a quotation. So Trapp looks at things very differently. It's not like a Matthew Henry, Matthew Poole, John Gill type of commentary. Kind of different. Is it well worth having? Yes, absolutely. But it is different. It's not going to go through every single clause. He just he adds a little bit of flavor. After you've done all your work, if you've done all your expositing and everything else, and then you go back, you're right about the preacher, and you look at that commentary. So, and that's kind of where it's useful. But he made that great point there about, in other words, the Eternal One is without passions and without affections. And I want to think about that word affections. I think it can be, it's not false, but it can be unhelpful to think of God without emotions. We struggle to talk about God. I think it's more helpful and easier to understand, or to apprehend at least, that God has perfections, not affections. And when you think about affections, think about cause and effect. If I am cooking and I leave my hand on the cooker and I burn my hand, the cause is the heat, excess heat on the cooker. The effect is the pain. And the cause will cause an effect. So, and something that has been affected suffers to go undergo change. I think it's better if we think about affections. You have affections. I have affections. We are suffered to undergo change. You come home from a long day of work and you're quite hungry and you smell food for the first time coming through the door. That affects you. You have affections. That thing, that object of your desire, the food, the dinner plate, or whatever it is, your love for that food grows the more you smell it. God is different to us. God is love. But we can never be described as love. We love things, which is a changing affection in us. We love our wife, we love our children, but that love goes up and down. And it is affected by the object of our affection. God has perfections. God was most loving before the foundation of the world. God will be forever and is without any shadow of turning. So God has perfections, not affections. We have affections. If we turn, just to think about this, Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14. God reveals himself to Moses and speaks out of the burning bush. Now we also have to remember there's no form of similitude, there's no likeness that Moses saw there, as we're told in Deuteronomy chapter 4. But in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14, God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am, hath sent me unto you. God is who he is. Who he is his being. Because he's not made up of parts. So God can never suffer to change and cease to be whom he is. God has no affections, for he is not caused to be who he is, nothing, because otherwise he would be dependent on something outside of himself, which would deny his aseity, his self-reliance, his self-dependence. And neither can he suffer to change, which then actually ties in with immutability. God is immutable, as in he cannot change. And if we have a God with passions, he is a God who changes. And I've seen quotes like this. I don't want to be picking on anyone, one or two people, but there's a quote that's kind of gone around by John Frame from the Systematic Theology that is troubling, and others as well. So this is something that we're going to come across. And what would I do? I would urge you not to be overly reliant on modern day systematic theologies. They can be helpful in places. Of course they can. But there's many deficiencies. How many of them will be around in 50 years' time, 100 years' time? Maybe prior to Burkhoff era, there's some good famous ones. And by the way, even if you go back to the 19th century, Charles Hodges isn't perfect. He's well worth reading. So read widely. Read widely. And obviously the high point in a lot of these things, 16th and 17th century. But there are some early church fathers who are good on these areas at times. It just depends. You have to read with discernment. Now, let's look at a definition for affection. And I got this quote, actually, from God Without Passions, a primer by, I'll just get the author's name, Samuel Roynihan. So, I found this quote in this. And I'm going to talk about Samuel Roynihan's book in a second. It's an excellent book, and I would highly recommend everybody get it. But I'll talk about that in a second. Probably at the end of the show, actually. But if I don't remember it, Samuel Roynihan's book, he's a Baptist minister, holds to the 1689 London Baptist Confession of Faith. This is a small C Catholic doctrine. This is something that all Christians should hold to, regardless of your background. I think it's less than 100 pages, I believe, a little bit over 100 pages. And it's a kind of a book, it's very pastoral, and I could give it to anybody. It's even called a practical and pastoral study of divine impassibility. And it is the most practical and pastoral book on this topic that I've come across. And I think there's a lot to be commended in the book, just in making it as accessible, a doctrine such as this as accessible as possible. And I think that's one of the big problems, is sometimes we can teach these doctrines in lecture halls and talk about them in certain ways. And there's a place for that, and there's a place for the technical language, and there's a place for the master theses and the dissertations that you do for PhDs. There's a place for all of that. But we've also not tried to get it as simply as possible to the average person, and to try and teach the average person about our God who is without passions, and how that is a comforting doctrine. And in order to understand how it's a comforting doctrine, we've got to understand what an affection is. Now, having gone through all these things, I want to make sure that people don't misunderstand me. Don't make your sermons heavy and dense and packed with quotations. What I'm going through here, which would be much like a lecture. And you got to know the people in front of you. And you got to know what they're able for. And you may teach a little bit of a here and a little bit of a there. But you realize that these things, a lot of people may never have heard before. So, but what is an affection? William Fenner, I think he was a 17th century Puritan, said this: the affections are the passions of the soul, when the heart is affected with a thing, it lets in that thing, and it suffers a change by that thing. When a man is affected with anger at a wrong or injury, we say he is in passion. That is, he lets in the wrong, and there does his heart bite upon the wrong and chase at it. Thus he is passionate. When a man is affected with love to a pleasure, he lets in the pleasure and suffers it to prevail on the heart. So he's talking about there, this is William Fenner, he's talking about passions of the soul, affections. When we love something, that thing affects us and causes a change within us. And that really should shape as well, when we think about this, our lives and what we let into our hearts and what we love and our hobbies and all sorts of things. I'm not going to prescribe do this and don't do that kind of thing here, but I'm talking about we need to be careful of what we let cause a change within us. You see the implication of it here. When we love something, that thing affects us. It causes a change within us. We are affected by it. An affection. We are changed in affections for something which caused such change to be. Does that mean that God does not care? No. God is love. God is infinite in love. He is infinite in mercy, compassionate, long-suffering, and unchangeably so. And if he could change, what would that do for being infinite? So if he could suffer to change and have affections or passions, then he would be no longer without limit loving or infinitely loving. You have created a creature, an idol, when you have a God with passions. If he could change to love more, he lacked in love, and he had potential to love more. That's denying divine simplicity, by the way. If he could love less, then he's less loving as a result, and he's been affected to be somehow. It's been caused to change, and it does impact on our view of immutability, or that God is not able to change. Our God without passions is immutably loving and eternally merciful. He cares perfectly and eternally. I am who I am, the Lord said to Moses. He is love. He is identical to his attributes. He is wisdom. He is truth. He is life. Now, what's really comforting about this as well, if God can be caused to be affected in some way, he is changed to being something else. And because he cannot change, we are not consumed. His promises are true. His gospel is true and unchangeably so. We see this expressed in Malachi. I don't want to spend too long because it does impact on the doctrine of immutability, but Malachi in chapter 3 and verse 6. Malachi in chapter 3 and verse number 6. For I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. See how comforting that is. God says, I don't change. Because if he did change, be just like the gods of ancient mythology, who would change their mind, be affected by things, and be enraged. Our God does not change. And so we who trust in him, who do change. We change. We suffered affections. We suffered to be changed. We trust in the one who does not and cannot change. And so his promises, he cannot deny himself. And that is wonderfully, wonderfully comforting. Now, okay, we gotta deal with the elephant in the room, and one of the big elephants in the room, but you're probably saying, but Paul, there's all this language in the Bible that seems to suggest that God has passions. God, you know, wrath and things like that, and we know the passages, you know, the passages seem to suggest that God is grieved in his heart, that is suffered to, well, we would say suffering, but he has suffered to undergo change, he's undergoing something that brings him away, if you took this literally, away from his blessed happiness. How do we understand language about God in the Bible? This is so, so, so vital. When we come to language about God, we have to understand that God is speaking to us in a creaturely way, because otherwise we wouldn't understand it. We are creatures. We are finite. And he speaks to us in a creaturely language. God is without limit. And we have to understand language in terms of being time-bound, with limitations. Sometimes the scriptures will talk about his mercy reaching unto the clouds. But does it stop at the clouds and go no further? No. But all this language is to show us and convey to us as creatures this truth. God is infinite, without limitation. He is the one who fills heaven and earth. He is incomprehensible. So how does the infinite, the one who's without limitation, describe himself to us puny, finite, limited creatures? He speaks to us using creaturely language. Yes, with real meaning, and we have to get into this now. But we cannot forget who God is when we look at these verses. I have a quote from R.C. Sproul that I'm going to look at in a second. But Genesis chapter 6 and verse 6. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 6. Just to have one example of how we cannot take it one for one literally. In Genesis chapter 6 and verse 6. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. There's a lot of verses like this. So that God changed his mind. He had this idea, and then he changes. And then is he grieved? It does tell us about God. But it does not tell us about a change in God. It tells us about, from the perspective of us finite creatures, the actions of God toward us. The actions of God in time. Otherwise, we can never speak about God. We cannot understand this language as what is called univocally or univocally. Uni, one, vocal, voice. One voice, no, we can't speak one to one. If you say, you know, I am a man. That's univocally or univocally. But if I said, okay, you go to the zoo, right? I'll give you an illustration here. And we do use language that's not literal all the time. If you said, you go to the zoo, you're giving meat to, and it's a little lion, and Tom is a lion. Well, that's a one-to-one. Literal. We know from the context and everything. But if you say, Tom is a lion, and you know it's a person, what does it conveys real truth. He is what? Courageous. Maybe it means he's powerful. Or sometimes we use the word, you know, someone's a fox. The cunning. But we don't think that they're a literal animal, fox. So we use language often that is not to be understood univocally, even for people. When we come to the scriptures, we've got to look at it in its context, but we've also got to understand God theologically, as in he cannot change because the scriptures reveal and tell us that the Lord our God is one. That he is the great I am, the unchangeable I am. Passions do not properly belong to God. They are only there as an analogy. Analogy. And so when we speak about God here, repenting, being grieved, passions with anthropomorphisms and other things like that, we are speaking about him as an analogy. Now, it doesn't mean that it says nothing, that there's no similarity or point of reference between God and men. There is, because we've been made in the image of God. God is love. We have love, and we are to follow God. We're to imitate God, as Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1. Like, there's three types of language. Univocally, one-to-one. There is an analogical language, which is the language you're going to be looking at about God. And there's equivocal language, where there's no point of similarity. Where it's equivocal, it's not clear. There might be words that you don't really know the meaning of it. There might be words that sound the same, and there's no clear meaning. This is not what we're saying about God. There is clear, concrete meaning and truth being communicated here. When it says about it repented, Lord, that he made man on the earth, it's not talking about a change within God. But it's speaking about how God is with respect to what is going on at the time. That God hates sin and does not approve of this. That's what's being communicated here. Not a change in God. Just going to give you just something, maybe hopefully make it a little bit clearer when we talk about analogical language. Analogical language, and this is from the glossary at the back of Matthew Barrett's book, Simply Trinity. It says, analogical likeness between one thing and another. God is infinite and incomprehensible. Therefore, the finite creature's language for God says something true about God, but is not to be taken in an exhaustive or literalistic way. Okay? So the similarity between, so God is infinite and incomprehensible, but man has been created in the image of God. So analogical language. I want to quote from R.C. Sproul as well, because I think his explanation is very, very helpful. This quotation is coming from God's Love, R.C. Sproul. How the Infinite God Cares for His Children. A very good book. A book that really helped me years ago when I read this. Sproul had an ability to take things that you read them in other works, and you're a bit mystified by the end of it. But Sproul had a a wonderful gift of being able to take these truths and doctrines, I think largely because of his training, to explain these things. And in page number 29 of God is Love, Sproul wrote, "When we speak about God, we recognize that to a certain extent our speech is anthropomorphic and analogical. Anthropomorphic speech describes God in human forms. We see anthropomorphic language in the Bible when God is described as a sort of gigantic man or superman. He has a strong right arm, Psalm 89 verse 13. He has eyes, ears, nostrils, legs that use the earth as his footstool, Psalm 11 verse 4, 2 Chronicles 7 verse 14. Psalm 18 verse 9, Isaiah 66 and verse 1. Yet as helpful as these images may be in revealing certain things about God, we are warned not to take them too far, as if they were univocal or univocal, one voice, descriptions of him. We are also told that he is not a man, but a spirit who cannot be contained in time and space the way a physical being with real arms, legs, and eyes can be. 2 Corinthians 3:17. And our language about God moves beyond graphic and concrete images such as arms and legs to more abstract language. We tend to think we have escaped the limits of anthropomorphic language. In fact, we never can. All of our language about God is always anthropomorphic because that is the only language at our disposal. Remember, we're saying about creaturely language. Sproul goes on to say, it is the only language we have because we are anthropi, or anthrope, that is men. That's the Greek word for men. God does not address us in his language. We cannot understand it. Rather, he condescends to speak to us in our language. He reveals himself to us in terms we can understand. As John Calvin once said, it is akin to the communication we use with infants. We coo and lisp to them in what we call baby talk. Now, wonderful. Do you see the picture here? It's not that it's not true. It's that God speaks to us in the language we can understand in the same way we would come down to a child or a baby to coo and lisp, to have them understand. Lovingly, he does so. He speaks to us in creaturely language. But we also have to remember that he's holy, 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 and he is not a creature at all. So we cannot understand passages and texts that appear to present a God of passions. And by the way, this is the error that the Socinians fell into. Oh, the Bible says this, and that's it. And the Socinians in history had a very high opinion of the text of Scripture. But to ignore the fact that God is not a creature when we look at these texts is to run henceforth into heresy. Many, in a very glib way, have ignored the voices of the past and just thought, well, I don't need the voice of the past. I don't need that talk about language. It's okay. We need to be very careful. We're speaking about the infinite God, the one who's out limits, the one who's made heaven and earth, the one who sustains and maintains all things, the one who's incomprehensible. And when we speak about him, we need to speak according to truth and exalt him and reverence him and be in awe of him, because that's what we're going to do for all eternity. And so when we see such language, it is analogical language. There is truth to be said about God, but it's not to be taken literalistically and exhaustively to the point where you see God as a creature. it does have truth to say. So I don't want anybody coming away from this thinking, well, we can't apprehend God, we can't know God. This is not what I'm saying. And misunderstood, you could go off in an agnostic, I can't know God kind of thing. That's not what this is about at all. But neither do we want to fall into the opposite ditch. We make God formed to our own tastes and desires. An idol. A puny vanity. And Paul and Barnabas, when they were speaking to these idolaters in Lystra, spoke to them that they would turn from such vanity, such useless things, such empty things, to the living and true God. So we must turn from idols to the living and true God. We do understand what it says is some clear truth about who God is, but you must understand it's from a creaturely perspective or view. I pray that that's been a help. Again, this is kind of an extended one about from a talk I did a few weeks ago. I know that there can be some questions about Christ's suffering as well. We must remember with Christ, he is truly God and truly man. Christ suffered in his divine nature. No, sorry. Excuse me. In his human nature. It's very easy to misspeak in this topic. Yeah. So Christ, yes, he suffered as God-man. Absolutely. But the suffering on the cross did not touch his divine nature. Now, he did suffer as God-man, and the way I'll describe it is this. From the point of view of man, he could suffer. From the point of view of God, his sufferings were of infinite worth and value. He's the Son of God. Now, the sufferings of Christ and Christology and the various difficulties that come into that. Christ, in his human nature, had passions. But he never ceased to be true God. So in his divine nature, he's one person, two natures. Christ is both God and man. And as God, without passions. As man, with passions, yet without any sinful passions. But assumed human flesh. I'm going to quote briefly, because I remember during the talk a few weeks ago, questions of this kind of came up. And it was a very interesting quote I found afterwards by Athanasius. The great defender of the Trinity and against Arian heretics in the early church, said this. He showed that he had a body, not in appearance, but in truth, speaking about Jesus. It was appropriate for the Lord, when he put on human flesh, to put it on whole, together with the sufferings proper to it, so that just as we say that the body belongs to him himself, so we may also say that the body's sufferings belonged to him himself, even though they did not touch him as far as his divinity was concerned. You see what Athanasius is saying there? And the quotations found, this is quote, the quotation I found is in Cyril of Alexandria's writings, the three Christological treatises. Cyril of Alexandria was one very good defender of the two natures of Christ. He largely wrote against Nestorianism. What was it? The 5th century, I think it was. But he quotes from Athanasius, and this quotation is coming from Contra Arianus, which is basically against Arius. But do you see what Athanasius is saying here? So we may, just to quote it again, so we may also say that the body's sufferings belong to him himself. Okay? Even though they did not touch him as far as his divinity was concerned. So, with Christ, we have two natures, one person. We don't have two-part people because that would be drifting into Nestorianism. We also have to make sure we keep the distinctiveness of the natures. They're not confused with each other and they're not mixed or anything else like that. Also, we can go into other heresies known as Eutychianism and other things like that, which very much emphasizes the one person of Christ, but not the fact that he's two natures. But I think that would be larger for another day as well. But Christ did suffer because he assumed human flesh. But in his divine nature, without passions, as touching his divine nature, without passions. Books for further study. The book I mentioned earlier, Samuel Reinhan's book, God Without Passions, a primer, a practical and pastoral study of divine impassibility. This is published by RBAP. It's Reformed Baptist. What is the name of the publisher again? RBAP anyway, and you can find it on Amazon, I'm sure. That is short pastoral writing, probably the most accessible writing that I found on this so far. And then, something a bit more challenging, I suppose, would be an intermediate level, but a good introduction to classical theism. Now, this book does not just deal with God without passions, but will get you into the whole world of what we'll call classical theism, to think about divine simplicity, God without body, parts, or passions. And that would be the book, All That Is in God, by James Dolezal, published by Reformation Heritage Books. And that book is astonishing. R.C. Sproul loved it so much he wanted to read it again. And again, I think he read it twice, he said, when he was interviewing James Dolezal. And he said he was going to read it again, I think, during that interview. So, that would be what I would call intermediate level. But a very good introduction all the same into this whole thing. And a book that, there's very few books that have changed how I look at things. But that book by James Dolezal really woke me up. I read it a few years ago. When was it? Might have been 2022. 2-3 years ago. And I remember just thinking, it scared me how sloppy I was in these areas myself. Look where it all gone wrong on that. No, this is an area I really need to work on. And I had some idea of it, but it was poor. And, I would commend that book to you. And then if you want something a bit more challenging on impassibility, a book I've read most of and was really helpful is Confessing the Impassible God, the Biblical, Classical, and Confessional Doctrine of Divine Impassibility. It's one of the editors is Richard Marcellus, along with others as well. And that's published by RBAP as well. I've read about 90% of it, very helpful. And more advanced. So I suppose if you want to, you've read God Without Passions, you've read All Is in God, and you want more, and you specifically want to look at impassibility, personally, I would go in there next. And beyond that, I'm going to keep studying myself. I hope you will. If you have read anything helpful on this, please feel free to email me, miguelradio@gmail.com. I don't profess to be an expert on these things or anything like that, but I think because there's so many errors in this, I think hopefully it will be helpful to you. This is something that we must know if we're swearing to the Westminster Confession of Faith or the 1689 London Baptist Confession of Faith or the Savoy Declaration or the 39 Articles or whatever you claim to believe. You should know this because you've sworn that you do. You've made an oath before God that you do. But as Christians, we should know these things. And we may not feel we can defend these things all, but have an idea. And if you're going to go no further than anything else, I would definitely recommend Simon Reinhorn's book, God Without Passions, A Primer. And I think I've even given one or two people, friends of mine, who've showed any interest in this. I've sent them a book on it. And it's a good thing to whet somebody's appetite that doesn't go over your head. And so hopefully that's been a blessing to your soul. Again, if any questions, we get a radio at gmail.com. And remember, the great, wonderful thing about this is we serve a God who's not subject to be changed like us. That's a good thing. Because if our God suffered to undergo change, we'd be in a lot of trouble. And that God cannot save us. The God who's without passions, the one who's not suffered to undergo change, the one who's without affections, the one who does not change, is Him we trust, and is because of Him who does not change, who does not suffer to change, we are not consumed by faith in His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. This is from Paul Flynn. May God bless you all.